position is and why our position is the way it is. And so we want to make sure that we've thought through it. And that's the exercise right now. Think through it. Not that you're going to think through it much right now. But some of the questions you might be struggling with is because, well, I never thought about it before. I don't know how to think about it. I need some sort of standard, some sort of guide to tell me. Yeah, that's right. And that's the point. All right. So let's finish up this morning's lessons with choosing the right worldview here. And how do you go about choosing the right worldview anyway? Well, I'll need you to advance it, Brother Bob. Well, finding the right worldview requires finding the right answers. Part of the exercise there in your worldview study guide is being presented with a series of questions, dealing with a number of issues, and having the right answer to these questions is going to guide you and narrow down which worldview is correct. There are organized worldviews in the world today that really can have already gotten the answers. And so it's very nice to be able to say, all right, there's only a few worldview, whereas there are thousands of questions. So we want to find the right answers. Oh, boy. Okay, there we go. All right. So what is the right choice and what is the right answer for a variety of questions is what we can ask for. Should people bother being married? How do you determine that adultery is wrong, abortion is wrong, or killing is wrong? How do you determine if a law is right or wrong? What about welfare and genetic engineering and cloning? What about those? Boy, that's more difficult. The Bible's not in that, doesn't have anything to say about cloning or genetic engineering. How do you determine that you think right or correctly about some things? How do you determine if your answers to these questions are correct? Where do you go and how do you find it out? Well, the bottom line is that when you start listing out all the questions that there are to be asked and to answer, you realize, man, there's such a bombardment of a multitude of questions and ideas every day. How can I possibly determine what the right answer is for all these questions? It would take me more than a lifetime to find all the answers to all these questions. And so most people, as a result, being overwhelmed, they just throw up their hands and say, it's impossible. I can't be bothered with it. I'm not going to do anything with it. And as a result, by default, then, if we're not doing it by reason and reading the Bible, what's left? Well, whatever we pick up as contagion or whatever feels good, and we say, well, that sounds fine to me. And so then we slip into those other false worldviews, don't we? And so we need to be careful about that and not be guilty of being lazy. Determining which idea is correct is important because good decisions require good information as well as good thinking skills. Again, going back to our churches as education centers, we need to be teaching people how to think, how to be educated. And I know that's not fun for a lot of people, but it needs to happen because in our world today, that's what we're being challenged with. When you put a Christian up against a humanist, you're putting up a Christian, you're putting up a person who doesn't have to think against a person who has to think. What do I mean by that? A humanist has a God. And who is that God? Themselves. And what makes sense out of that God? Themselves. What they think, reasoning, thoughtfulness. That is the God of humanists. The humanistic God is all about the brain, about the mind, about thoughtfulness. And so if you put a thoughtful person, if you put a person whose God is thought and reasoning up against a person who doesn't need to think or reason, man, there's not a contest. And so we need to be education centers in our churches teaching people how to think. Millions of babies are being slaughtered every year in the womb just because of a lack or just plain bad information being pumped out. Good decisions are only as good as the information that you have. But the task of sorting through, you know, 1,000 questions, man, that looks overwhelming. So let's talk about a couple ways we can simplify this. First of all, answers can be grouped into worldviews. We've been talking about worldviews, haven't we? We've been seeing a number of ideas. I want to make sure we understand the distinction between ideas and worldviews. But a worldview is a collection of thoughts and ideas, as we've said. But have you ever noticed something very interesting about people? Have you ever noticed that pro-abortionists, or I should say baby killers, like to save whales? In fact, generally people who condone killing babies are usually for sodomy. They're usually soft on criminals. They believe in freedom of speech for everyone but Christians. They want to legalize marijuana and drugs of all sorts. Now, here's the question I want to raise. Why do people who take positions on one issue usually take a predictable position on another issue? What is that all about? What that suggests and tells us is that there is some underlying guiding system of thought that's already determining the conclusion that they're going to take. There's something at the root of their ideology, their collection of ideas. And at the root, we call that their worldview system. That's what we call it. So what is a worldview? Well, it's a comprehensive perspective about life and the world. It's a collection of beliefs and values and ideas. It's the reference point from which you look at everything and evaluate everything, a standard or not having a standard. It's the window. It's like looking through a window, and if it's a rose-colored window, the world looks rose-colored out there. If it's amber, or like those amber sunglasses, everything looks amber out there. You see, the window that you're looking through is like your worldview. It colors the world and determines how you're perceiving the world around you. And so that is what your worldview is. And this is why at the root of all the ideas and conclusions that people have, we find worldviews. Now, the nice thing about talking about worldviews, rather than a multitude of 1,001 questions and ideas that we have to determine the right answer for, there's only a few organized worldviews. Now, doesn't that look a whole lot easier? I mean, if all those ideas are predictable based on, that is, they have predictable answers based on the worldview, then you don't have to find an answer to every idea. All you have to do is find out which is the right worldview. And there's just a handful of worldviews. Life just got a whole lot easier. From 1,001 questions to 8 worldviews or so. Now, that just made it a whole lot easier. Now, the Marxist worldview is a collection of ideas and perspectives of Karl Marx. Oh, he got it named after him. Frederick Jameson wrote, to create this is very interesting, this is where we are today. Frederick Jameson wrote, to create a Marxist culture in America, to make Marxism an unavoidable presence and a distinct, original, and unmistakable voice in American social, cultural, and intellectual life. In short, to form a Marxist intelligentsia for the struggles of the future, this seems to me the supreme mission of a Marxist pedagogy and a radical intellectual life. I mean, we're talking about agenda here. There is a worldview warfare. There's a worldview warfare strategy. There is an agenda, and the Marxists have an agenda to gain control of the culture through power and education. Marxism is, as Frederick Jameson went on and wrote, he said, Marxism is well known for its dialectic materialism philosophy. Dialectic materialism, what is that? That's exactly what we see in evolution. It's a phrase when Marx was looking and applying Darwin evolution to economics and social life, he derived this concept of dialectic materialism. Materialism is, well, there's nothing but the materialistic world. That's all there is, the real world, materialism. Dialectism is teaching or instructive, isn't it? So it's the materialistic world that is self-instructive, a self-instructing world. And that's where survival of the fittest, natural selection, evolution comes into play, because the biological world is constantly improving and evolving with selecting out that which is fitter, the survival of the fittest. That's what's going on in Marxism, is that there is a fitter model of economy and social structure as we progress through time and history. Because there's always this ongoing struggle between a thesis and an antithesis that is struggling. That's your worldview in control versus your opposing worldview that's struggling to overcome. And then after that struggle, it out pops a synthesis. A synthesis, which then becomes the ruling worldview, which then a rising opposition worldview comes into play, and then you have thesis, antithesis working against each other, and then out pops a synthesis. And this is dialectic materialism as described by Marxism in our world to explain the power struggles, the class struggles that are going on. That's Marxism, and we have it going on in our world now. And then secular humanism is on the rise. How many have seen the buses and the billboards? Good without God? Can you be good without God? But the billboard says, yeah, we are. Tired of God? We are too. I mean, it goes on and on. They've got a campaign going on, secular humanists are running campaigns to be evangelistic and gain converts to atheism or their secular humanism. Secular humanism is about a collection of ideas and opinions derived from an organized group of humanists who record and write in the Humanist Manifesto. It's a journal that goes way back to the 1920s, I believe. And when I found it up in the University of Arkansas's library, they have everyone back to the first issue, and you can find all the issues of all the humanist journals and how they are debating and questioning and strategizing and fine-tuning their agenda to accomplish their goal of gaining control over the culture. And so there's two interesting points about humanism. And that is that there is a religious humanism and there is a secular humanism. You say, a religious humanism? How can humanists be religious? Well, Islam is humanistic, isn't it? Oh, well. Well, is it biblical? Is it God's worldview? No. Well, then what is it? It must be a humanistic worldview, right? It doesn't matter what you believe in. You can be a humanist and still believe in God. You just don't believe in the right God. Now, Islam is a good example of that, because Islam is a worldview, a competing worldview that's coming on strong and fierce in our world. Second major religion in the world. Fastest growing religion in the world, primarily by birth. Islam has been in the news quite a bit, hasn't it? And it's dominating our news, and we see hear a lot about the terrorists. They follow the teachings of Muhammad in the writings of the Quran. Their God is Allah. In 2009, there was an estimated population of 1.7 billion Muslims, which is the world one-third of the world's population. And I'm not sure where they are now, but they are increasing. We've got a worldview that is overcoming Europe, Islam. In fact, they're predicting that even France is, of course, France is starting to maybe they get a wake-up call. We'll see if Le Pen wins or her opponent. But there's a lot of controversy going on about Islam, and even in London. I mean, Britain is not Britain anymore. It's not what it used to be. And same way with in America, we got a city up in Minnesota that is Muslim controlled. And we've got Muslims taking over positions of government and introducing the Quran and elements of Sharia law into the American culture already. And then there is another worldview, and that is New Ageism or mysticism. That encompasses many different teachings, so it's a little more obscure and difficult to define. It's an extremely large and loosely structured network of beliefs, including the idea that, hey, we're all one. And that's where you get your tree huggers, and you get people talk about nirvana and oneness with the world, and how you're one drop water spray in the ocean, and then you drop back in, and the principle of reincarnation. And many of these thoughts, the age of Aquarius and the age of peace that it's supposed to bring us right now. The caption to this picture sums up pretty much what New Ageism is all about. The goddess here links with mankind to create harmony. Her wing gently cradles her human form, and a complex series of tunnels containing her deepest thoughts are transmitted via bridges and pathways to a willing pupil. It's all, in other words, we're all interconnected there. And that's why New Ageism is sort of a catch-all pot of all kinds of crazy things. Then there is the satanic worldview, which is a worldview in an all on its own. Anton LaVey, who is pictured here, now deceased, and knows better, he wrote the Satanic Bible. He was alive and well back when I was a student in the 70s, Charles Manson and other crazy things going on, witchcraft, Satanism, people, news stories coming out about how people were jumping over fences, grabbing people's children and hopping over the fence with their kids and taking them in cars and having human sacrifices throughout L.A. area. It was crazy. And then they were finding these shallow graves and even picking up people with human fingers in their pockets. It was a crazy time during that time. Anton LaVey was big back in that time. He started the First Church of Satan up in San Francisco. Shouldn't surprise any of us that it was there. He wrote the Satanic Bible, which all he did was go through the Bible. And everything the Bible says to do, he says don't do. And everything the Bible said not to do, he said do. And then when I was ministering to a warlock up there in Northwest Arkansas who had miraculously come to the Lord, yep, even witches and warlocks can be saved. But he said there was only one rule that they lived by, and that was do whatever you want and don't get caught. That was their rule. But that is a hedonistic, no self-control, no self-restraint whatsoever, satanic worldview. And then there is the Christian worldview, the biblical worldview, which is a collection of beliefs and ideas taught by God in the Bible. Christians who follow the teaching of Jesus Christ have a biblical worldview. And it's a nice package of truths and ideas on how to think about everything. And it's relevant for today. One of the attacks and challenges that our worldview, the biblical worldview, is faced with is that the biblical worldview is old, obsolete, and irrelevant. That is being pumped out over and over and over again, even to our youth, even in our churches today. These churches, that's a thing of the past. That's old, obsolete religion. We don't need a church. We don't need a pastor. We don't need the Bible. We are in touch with God. And we can do it at home just as well as we can do it in a building. We can do it wherever we want. Sounds like setting up the high places in Israel, doesn't it? Hey, we can set up our own religion. We can do it our own way. Now, each of these worldviews are identified by their source, their originator, aren't they? Each has a comprehensive view of most aspects of life, from government to morality, from economics to biology, from religion to abortion, from marriage to parenting, from education to philosophy. It's all summed up in these worldviews, and they all have predictable conclusions to them. Humanists and Satanists want us to think that the Bible is only about a belief in God. Period. That's all they want us to do. But it's much more, isn't it? The Bible is God's manual on how to live and how to think. I mean, it's much more than just believing in God. When we look at this, the Word of God here, if I want to know something, and I mentioned during the last lesson, I went through an exercise of examining all my thoughts. Yeah, where's the verse on there? Where's the verse on that? And so on. I found some very interesting things. Some of my best studies came out of that. Like the one about Revelation 4:11. I was looking for a verse. Why did God create us in the first place? Well, I was looking for an answer to that question. I couldn't find a verse in the Bible anywhere except for two verses. And the one in Isaiah deals with the saved people already, the children of Israel. But Revelation 4:11 tells us that God created all things, and for his own good pleasure, we are and were created. Wow, there's the answer right there. And I thought, man, that's fantastic. Where's fellowship with God? That's the standard answer, isn't it? And then I was excited to find the answer, and at the same time I thought, well, that wasn't the answer I expected to find. But you see, what I was doing was going through what? The Word of God. I was looking for the Bible, a biblical worldview. We ought to be able to go through the Bible. Yes, it takes work. Fortunately, there's some people who have already done it for us, and we can, okay, what am I supposed to think? Well, let me go check out Dr. So-and-so and see what he thinks. Is that how we do it? Yeah, see, that raises the issue of, okay, how lazy am I going to be anyway? So, even if you are reading commentaries or somebody's writings, at the very least, you ought to be checking out with Scripture. Read it for yourself. You don't own it until you studied it out for yourself. And so it's very important to check it out and critique it nonetheless. But the Bible tells us that God created Adam and Eve. Secular humanism and humanists teaches that man evolved from monkeys. The Bible teaches that human life is precious. Secular humanists teaches that human life is no more sacred than a dog or a cow, or even less sacred than what we would apply to human life. Currently, there's an effort to grant all legal rights and privileges enjoyed by humans to apes. That's crazy. They will probably have, you know when that happens? This is how crazy our world is. If apes achieve the privileges and rights of humans, abortion will be illegal for apes, and it will be okay for humans. That's exactly how crazy our world is. The apes will have more rights and privileges than humans in this world. Now, actually, some of you may have already thought of this. Well, really, there's only two worldviews, what it comes down to. There's God's and there's man's. Well, you could say, well, it's God and Satan. Yeah, you could say that too. But we're talking about what we see in the world here, and people are latching on to, and Satan's providing a variety of worldviews for different humans. So it's okay to say that, yeah, there's two worldviews. In other words, we can lump all the worldviews and all their different ideas into one worldview, humanist. Humanist worldview. Sure, there's secular humanist worldview, but then there's the religious worldview too. So we got the whole package. It's God versus man is what it comes down to. We ultimately just have two worldviews. Now, I've been using this word humanism quite a bit. What is this humanism all about anyway? Humanism refers to human-derived ideas. If it didn't come from God, it came from man. Oh, prompted by Satan. Satan was the first rebellious soul in the universe. And Satan is attributed with a lot of things, but man comes up with his own views. He adheres to his own thinking. He likes his own ideas. Everyone's of their own opinion. Every man is right in his own eyes, bottom line. And so humanism is a good way to describe human-derived ideas that did not come from God, they came from man. And that gives us then the distinction between secular humanism, which is a perspective without God, like Marxism, materialism, hedonism, as opposed to mystical humanism or religious humanism, which has a perspective with God involved, or a spiritual dimension anyway, like transcendental meditation cult or the occult, a New Ageism, Islam, pseudo-Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism, all these isms are humanistic. You say Judaism. Well, Judaism, as it's practiced and taught today, is humanistic. That's why God rejected them, because they were teaching a false doctrine of salvation. That is by the law, by works. No, it's not. That's a humanistic idea. So human-derived ideas is what we're referring to. Anything that's not God's ideas is a humanistic worldview. And when we talk about humanism, there's a lot of different humanism applications because there's so many different humanists in the world, and they don't all agree, which is not surprising. But here the word humanism is defined by a humanist, Frederick Edwards. Humanism has a number of meanings, and those who try to explain humanism can easily become a source of confusion. I like to put this up there because you'll hear other definitions of humanism than I use, and I'm just letting you know. When you're in a world of humanism, you're in a world of confusion. That's what it comes down to. All right, so because there's humanists in every endeavor of human activity, there's literary humanism, Renaissance humanism, cultural humanism, philosophical humanism, Christian humanism, modern humanism, secular humanism, religious humanism. Did you notice the Christian humanism? And that? See, the humanists recognize there's humanism in Christianity as well. And those are the guys that think right, because they think like them. So, yes, humanists, the humanist worldview is all-encompassing. Part of the strategy and the agenda of that worldview is to encompass and include everything, to have answers to everything, and bring everyone together into unity, humanistic thought. So, spiritual humanism is denying spiritual reality, whereas religious humanism doesn't deny it. It includes it, but from a humanistic perspective. All right. So, with all these humanistic ideas and human-derived ideas, every question that you have answered and every question you've seen me pose to you, there's a humanistic idea. So what are we to do to confront these ideas and give an answer? How is it possible to answer all these questions? Well, it is, with four questions, as I told you. We can take each one, every issue, every question, put them into our simplifying machine, and distill it all down to finding truth. And what is that? What are those questions? All right. Well, with these four questions, we're going to be able to answer every question simply and easily. At least find the worldview with all the right answers is what we're looking for. So, the first question of the four fundamental questions. Is there more than a physical world? Well, there is more than a physical world. But what is the evidence for that? Can you present the evidence for more than a physical world to somebody? Because we're talking about competing worldviews, right? The second question is there a God? Which leads to that, because you see, you might believe that there's more than a physical world, but not necessarily a God. Who are we looking at there? New Agers, right? The New Age worldview and some of the Buddhist sects who believe that even Buddha didn't believe in the God that he is today. His followers made him a God. So is there a God? That's a question that's number two that has to be asked. The third question derives from that. All right? Well, which God is it? If there is. Now, if I can show you that Jesus Christ is God, what's the next question? Well, the next question is, Well, how does God reveal truth? Anyway. Now, once I determine where the source of truth is and revelation is, then how do I find the answer to all the questions in life? There I go. Now, that's not new to most of you, to all of you, but here's what's significant about these four fundamental questions. This is how we deal with and how we approach reaching the atheists or the secularists. For example, this has real-world application. When I am talking to somebody and I meet somebody, the first thing I do is I try to evaluate where is their starting point. This is where presuppositionalism enters in. Anybody heard of presuppositionalism? Well, pre means I'm doing something ahead of time, that is, before I suppose. I'm supposing something. I'm going to presume that with an idea. I'm going to start out with a conclusion and work forward. Now, there's some interesting historical ebb and flow of ideas that led to this point. But let me give you a quick illustration of presuppositionalism in Christianity, because presuppositionalism has been a big deal and sometimes more important at sometimes in history than others. But recently, presuppositionalism has been a big deal and become a part of Christian apologetics, which I think has been a big mistake. And that was demonstrated in the Ham and Nye debate. Ham and Rye, but it's Ham and Nye. Anybody see the Ham and Nye debate? Creation debate with Bill Nye, the science guy, and Ken Ham. Now, the debate was not about creation and evolution. Actually, it wasn't a debate at all. It was a critique, Bill Nye's critique of Ken Ham's creation scenario. Now, the question was, is it possible, listen to the question, is it possible to be a relevant scientist in today's world and believe in a literal interpretation of Genesis creation? All right, that was the question. That wasn't a debate question. That was the question to be critiqued. Ken Ham started out, and he answered the question. And in the first 20 minutes, it was a slam dunk. He won. He did win that, if we want to call it debate. He answered the question. And he did that by showing short video takes, interviews with real scientists, even the Nobel Prize winner who invented the MRI. Yes, I am a scientist. I have contributed to real-world science. I have answered real-world questions as a scientist, and I believe in a literal interpretation of the book of Genesis. Now, that settled the question. The question was answered. Yes, absolutely, you can be a scientist and believe in a literal interpretation of the Bible. But after that point, the debate began to take a different direction. Bill Nye started examining and critiquing the flood and Noah's Ark, and that's what he went after. And what was Ham's response? For those of you who were watching it, how did Ham answer those questions? He read Scripture. And how satisfying was that to Bill Nye? Not at all. How satisfying was that to all the humanists and atheists in the audience watching, millions of people watching that? It was not satisfying at all. How satisfying was it to all those who were creationists and Christians who were ready to let the world know that, yes, creationists have scientific answers? Yeah, there were a lot of disappointed people in the world that day. Why did it happen that way? Ken Ham did exactly what he said he was going to do. He is a presuppositionalist. He defends presuppositionalism, and he says, everybody's got a starting point, and my starting point is right here. Is that a wrong starting point? No, not at all. It's a correct starting point. But does that mean that Bill Nye needs to start there because that's the way Ham is starting? No, he doesn't have that starting point. Was there effective communication going on between the Christian and the secularist? Not at all. Why? Because the secularist does not start out with that presupposition. In other words, if you want to communicate and reach an atheist, you got to start out where their starting point is. You need to know who they are, as Paul would say. I become all things to all men that I might by all means save some. I need to find out who you are and where your starting point of thought is so I can address that, and we'll then start out where you are, not where I am, but where you are, and then we'll move forward. The value of these four fundamental questions is this, that at the root of all worldviews begins question number one, is there more than a physical world? That question necessarily precedes the next question, is there a God? You have to answer the question, is there more than a physical world? Marxism and secular humanism says, no, there is nothing more than a physical world. I have an atheist professor in Fayetteville who wants to debate me about the Bible, inspiration of the Bible. I said, no, I'm not going to debate you on that. Well, why not? Because you don't even believe that there's a God to inspire the Bible in the first place. What did I just do? I went through the four fundamental questions. Why am I going to debate inspiration when he doesn't believe in Jesus Christ in the first place, and he doesn't believe that there's a God to be Jesus Christ in the first place? He doesn't believe that there's more than a physical world. So what am I debating? To debate the inspiration of the Bible, I have to be debating four additional, I have to be debating four questions, three additional questions just to debate the inspiration question. And by that time, who is going to remember what the debate question was? I have to start with square one. Now, if someone already believes that there's a God, then but they don't know that it's Jesus Christ, do I have to begin with the evidence for God? No. But can I start with inspiration of the Bible? No. Because I have to, first of all, establish that there's a reason to believe that there's inspiration of the Bible, and it's not Buddha, and it's not Allah, it's Jesus Christ. So I've got to deal with which God first? So you see, these four fundamental questions are ordered in a particular way for a very important purpose. So the four fundamental questions here that we have to address and have answers to is there more than physical world? Is there a God? Which God is true God? And how does God actually reveal truth? There are questions. That takes all those 1,001 questions that you were bombarded with and sums it up, that once you get to a place where you know where truth is revealed, you can find all your answers. Now, we're talking about your witness, how you are communicating effectively to a secularized world. In Paul's day, it wasn't a secular world, it was a religious world. They already believed, for the most part, in God. He was dealing with which God? We live in a secularized world. We're dealing with the question of, is there even more than a physical world? Shortly after I came up with this lecture and worked up these four questions, the Lord did something with two very important people in my life to confirm, man, you're on the right track. It wasn't more than just a few hours after I finished the lecture series. My daughter came into the room. She was in first grade. And she comes and sits down and says, Daddy, how do you know that there's more than this world anyway? More than this world? I go, what? And so we were talking about, well, there's good reasons to know. And we talked about how there's a lot of things we don't, well, anyway, there's answers to it. You know what the second question she asked me? Well, how do you know there's a God? Oh, what? So we talked about how we know that there's a God. And then the next question she asked was, well, how do we know that God is Jesus Christ? And then she asked, how do we know that Jesus gave us the Bible? I mean, this coming out of a 7-year-old, I'm thinking, wow, Lord, how more clear can you make it? She walked through the progression of thought. That's just how logical it is. I was teaching a Thursday night Bible study on the book of Romans, and a friend, one of the boys brought a friend of his. And after the lesson, the guy came up to me and said, I wasn't really interested in the Bible, but Bible study, but I have questions for you. I said, okay, what are they? One, two, three, four. Now, when we got done, and I gave him more in-depth answers than I gave my daughter, but he said, who are you? He said, I was raised in a Christian home. I have walked away from the faith. That much as my own testimony, because there were no answers. He said, we got down to the fourth one on inspiration. He said, I don't have any more questions. I mean, that settles it. He said, I am faced with having to make a choice. Took 3 weeks, got saved. But you see, he was starting out with square one. That's where he was reduced to. That is the world we're living in right now. And if we're going to make headway and communicate, we need to do that. And I'll show you how fun this is. That when you answer the question, is there more than a physical world, you just knocked out two worldviews. And we'll see how that goes. Marxism, secular humanism. Now, what do I mean by knocking them out? Well, these are competing worldviews. If I can show you that there's more than a physical world, what does that mean about Marxism and secular humanism? They're starting out with the wrong premise. And a worldview starts out on the wrong foot is wrong. See, you have to cast that out. So we know those are wrong. And then we go to the second question. Is there a God? And if there's a God, then atheism is wrong. And New Ageism is wrong. Yeah, atheism can be spiritualist too, right? They can be religious. So what we did was we just knocked out two more worldviews with two questions. The worldviews are slimming down, aren't they, with two questions. Now watch this. We take our third question. Is Jesus Christ God? Which God? Whoops. So we establish that Jesus Christ is God. We knock out Islam. We knock out Hinduism and occultism. And then we knock out Buddhism and Judaism, which deny that Jesus Christ is God. Oh, man, life's getting easier already. Just three questions, we're down to two worldviews. And then we go through one more question, and that is, how does God reveal truth anyway? And we knock out all those that say, well, the Bible is just written by men. It wasn't inspired by God. It's not preserved. We just knocked it all out. With four fundamental questions, we just reduced the competing worldviews down to a real world worldview. Doesn't that sound easy? A whole lot simpler than trying to figure out all the answers to 1,001 questions, huh? Life just got simple. So what that means is with these four questions, we're establishing a foundation for truth, aren't we? We're establishing a basis to know what the correct worldview is. Now, many of you could probably say, well, I didn't derive my worldview, biblical worldview, from these, so it's not necessary. Are we talking about you? We're talking about effectively communicating to the world out there that is secular and biased. We're talking about people who are like me, who are like I was. I was an atheist. I was a secularist. That help me understand, what do these guys need to hear? And it all has a beginning point. And so if we can answer these four fundamental questions here, they will lead us to a foundation for the correct worldview. We don't have to be afraid of the answers, guys. We can ask these questions. Now, here is the benefit of it, because I have, and I'm addressing the apologetics of those who have rebuked me or rebutted me. You don't need to do that because you're putting human reasoning over God and faith. No, I'm not. Here's what this does, and what you just saw here, is that by answering these four fundamental questions, you are at, let me get this animation going. Here's what you're doing. You are knocking down the barriers that blind people from seeing the truth. All right? Now, when I was in my atheism, I met somebody who could answer my questions. I just said something very important there. He answered my questions, not his questions. He started out where I was, not where he was. He communicated to me, and in one meeting, he had me believing that there must be a God. I'm going to show you how to do that right after lunch. But you see what happens. We're not talking about saving souls because we can answer four questions. We're talking about helping to knock down those barriers that plug up the ears and close the eyes. You see, if Chuck Schwartz had begun to read the Bible to me, I would have got up and left. Why? I've already heard that, already been through that, already looked for the answers there. I didn't find it. I don't want to hear what you have to say. I want to hear answers to my questions. My ears were plugged up. My eyes were blinded. I did not want to hear the answers to his questions. I wanted answers to my questions. And that's how he communicated to me. That's how we communicate to the world. So with these answers, what we're doing is providing an answer to every man, to every man, to every man that asks of the hope that lies within us. To every man with all of their particular answers, the questions. They have their own set of questions. But look, these four fundamental questions can be reduced down to every person in the world. Whether they think about these questions, have thought about them or not, they all have answers to those questions. That's why when you talk to someone, you evaluate, where am I starting here? And from that starting point, then I know where I am. And I can begin to move forward and progress to the end goal, which is to share the gospel, so that then hearing the gospel, God gives a measure of faith to every man, doesn't he? And then upon hearing, what does Romans 10 say? They hear and they believe. That's what we want. So they're not going to hear the gospel unless we're answering their question. Give them a reason to hear. I needed to have a reason to hear and to listen to the gospel. I was glad someone gave me a reason. So the worldview idea is broken down into two sets. You got a biblical worldview, you have a humanistic worldview. And it really simplifies life quite a bit when we knock it all down and organize it into two worldviews and then be able to separate and distinguish those two worldviews with just four fundamental questions. And so all of these issues, all these questions are easily knocked down because why? It's all contained in one worldview, that's why. So I don't have to go through each position individually. I just have to know I go to the Bible. Well, you already knew that, but there's a whole world out there that doesn't know that. So your worldview determines what you see and how you see it. And here's a little fun exercise and how we'll end. Is that landscape? Or is that a face? It all depends on what worldview you have, right? How you see things is dictated by what's going on inside your head. Your worldview affects your interpretation of the world. Is that the face of a liar? Yeah. Well, it all depends on how you're looking at it. You can look at it either way. You see, that's what a worldview does. That's like creation and evolution we're going to look at in the next lesson. That creationists and evolutionists look at the same world, the same data, but they're seeing two different things. Now, the half full, half empty glass is, well, I don't know why that's jumping. Is that pro-life or anti-abortion. You know the language. It's the usage of words and semantics. It's going on in the world today. You anti-abortionists. Do you want to be an anti-abortionist or do you want to be a pro-lifer? And back when when this issue was coming up in the 60s after Roe versus Wade, it was always anti-abortionist, pro-life, anti-abortionist. It's always that way. It affects how we think about things. So it's worth taking a little time to investigate our worldview and ideas. Here's a summary of what we've talked about. A worldview is a comprehensive collection of ideas about life and the world. There's really two main worldviews, God's and man's. All man-made worldviews are humanistic. It doesn't matter whether they're religious or secular. And all worldviews can be sorted out with just four fundamental questions. I don't know about you, but it makes me feel happy every time I think about it. And I've been doing it for over 20 years, and I'm still happy about it. Worldviews affect the way we perceive and understand our world. So I hope that's been very enlightening to you, helpful to you. And then in the next lesson, I'm going to show you how to answer the first two questions and knock those off. How do we know that there's more than a physical world, and how do we know that there's God? Amen? All right.